Welcome to the Irish Legislation Podcast with me, Barry Ward, a podcast looking at legislation as it passes through Oireachtas in our National Parliament. Welcome to the seventh episode of the Irish Legislation Podcast, and today I am joined by Eoin O'Brien TD, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Midwest and the housing spokesperson for Sinn Féin, and Dr. David Kenny, Associate Professor of Law at Trinity College Dublin. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you very much.
I suppose we wanted to talk really about, Eoin, your bill, which is the 39th Amendment to the Constitution, the Right to a Home Bill. And this is a private member's bill that you have introduced proposing a constitutional amendment. Can you talk us through, first of all, what's in the bill and what the bill proposes to do?
Sure. So the bill is a very straightforward constitutional amendment. It seeks to enshrine the right to housing into the Constitution and also to place an obligation on the state to address issues of homelessness. We've been discussing this issue of a constitutional right to housing in the Oireachtas certainly since 2016. You remember in the interregnum before the then Fine Gael government was formed, the Dáil took a decision to set up a thing called the Dáil Housing and Homelessness Committee. It was a subcommittee of the Dáil, cross-party, and we spent, I think, 7 weeks producing a very detailed report on the then housing crisis. And one of the big issues was whether or not we should have a constitutional right to housing. While that was probably one of the few issues that committee couldn't reach agreement on, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, while open to considering the matter, hadn't landed on it in comparison to the rest of us. We subsequently had, I think, four separate dedicated hearings on the matter in the last Oireachtas, the Mercy Law Centre, a legal, human rights and housing organisation have done considerable work and research reports on the meaning of a right to housing in Ireland, international experience and comparisons. We had Leilani Farah, the UN Special Rapporteur on the right to adequate housing, who's a strong advocate of rights-based approaches to housing, present to us. And most recently, and very interestingly, Home for Good, which is a civil society campaign made up of legal experts, housing and homelessness NGOs and others, presented to the Oireachtas Housing Committee. And actually, they've proposed what's probably a better wording for a constitutional referendum than my own. And for the first time, certainly in my time in the Oireachtas, a majority of the members of the Housing Committee expressed a position in favour of such a referendum. And on foot of that, we're hopeful that Home for Good will meet with the minister. But, you know, whoever's wording, I suppose, ultimately, if this progresses, it'll be the Attorney General in consultation with the Minister for Housing and the government who decide. But really what this is about is placing a stronger and clearer obligation on government to ensure that through whatever policy means government decides, the right to secure and affordable accommodation is guaranteed, and the level of housing need that we have in our society at present is progressively diminished, subject, of course, to available resources, which is always the case with such things.
Do you think this is the only way in which that can be done in real terms?
One of the important points to raise when you're looking at enshrining social or economic rights in the Constitution is they are not a silver bullet. And one of the misconceptions of such a right is that the day after such a referendum were to pass, there would be a queue around the block at the Customs House with people waiting for their keys to a free home, which, of course, is not what such a right does. What it does is it places a stronger obligation on government to progressively realise that right. And I suppose the evidence over the last 30 years has been an evidence of sporadic government intervention and then failure to address a very broad range of housing need. Not just people, for example, who are experiencing homelessness or people at the fringes of our housing system, like travellers or people with disabilities or ethnic minorities, but an ever-growing number of people, including people with stable employment and good incomes, are finding it very difficult to access secure and affordable accommodation. So if you accept, as I do, that government, broadly speaking, has failed to guarantee access to secure and affordable accommodation through whatever means, then a constitutional right is one important element. On its own, will it solve the housing crisis? Of course not. We still need government to introduce policies and have appropriate levels of investment, etc. But it is one of the tools which I think most housing rights activists believe is valuable, and if combined with other measures, will absolutely make a difference.
Is there any country that you can name that has gone far enough to guarantee everybody unproblematically secure and affordable housing, or is it a problem across the world?
So there is no perfect housing system. There are no housing systems that I'm aware of that don't have difficulties. But there are housing systems that have far greater levels of housing provision and far lower levels of housing need than our own. So quite a number of continental European countries, for example, some Asian countries like Singapore or some Scandinavian countries fare much, much better. Finland, for example, has virtually eradicated long-term homelessness and has far greater levels of affordable housing provision. Countries like Germany and Austria, etc. But also, and this is quite an important point, Barry, there was a point in the history of this state where government policy ensured that a far greater level of people had access to secure and affordable accommodation. The period from the late 30s through till the early 1980s saw both through the provision of long-term low-interest loans and grants, owner-occupiers got access to secure and affordable accommodation, and likewise through far greater proportionate levels of investment in council housing, working-class families got far greater access. Now, all of that changed in the 1990s. So you don't necessarily have to go internationally. We have good experience and good practice here. Yeah. But I suppose what we're saying today is, and it's not just our view, let's remember the Constitutional Convention considered these matters in great detail in 2014 and in its subsequent report on social and economic rights. Over 80% of people at that convention voted to enshrine socioeconomic rights, including the right to housing, into the Constitution, having listened to all sides of the argument and deliberated on it as ordinary citizens. So is anywhere perfect? No. Are there places much better than we are? Yes, absolutely. And I suppose what we're trying to do is at all times increase the tools that allow government, local and central to meet people's housing needs or ensure that those housing needs are met through whatever policies are appropriate.
And the other jurisdictions you were mentioning there, like Scandinavia and other countries, do they have a constitutional right? Is it something that they have already?
So the Mercy Law Centre have done a really great report. So anybody who's interested in the finer detail of this should read that. And a range of countries have either legal rights to housing or constitutional rights. Not all of these countries, of course, have written constitutions, and some of them have different practices. Can I also say, however, there are countries that have constitutional rights to housing that have appalling housing levels and appalling need. I mean, South Africa is a very good example. It has a really great rights-based constitution, which was a product of civil society deliberation post-apartheid. But that hasn't addressed the issues because, of course, government hasn't followed through on it. So some countries have constitutional rights, others have legal legislative rights, others just have better practice. But again, I suppose, given the history of state failure in the view of people like myself, a constitutional right, given that it is a stronger form of legal protection than primary or secondary legislation, is our preferred option. Can I also say this, though? We've come out of a period at the Celtic Tiger where increasingly housing was seen as a commodity and not as a public good. And therefore, there is also an additional benefit of a constitutional referendum on the right to housing, which is we could have a conversation, a statewide conversation about the place of home and the function of housing in our value system. And that idea of seeing housing as a public good and something which is essential to human flourishing, as opposed to an asset class that we invest in, for example, to address our pension needs at an older stage, at an older point in our lives, etc. So I also think it's not just the winning the referendum, but having that debate. And if we reflect, for example, on marriage equality, it didn't just address a particular need of that section of our community, but it also allowed us to have what I think was a watershed conversation or watershed moment through that conversation about LGBTIQ plus equality. And therefore, I think the referendum would have a double value, enshrining the right and also having that national conversation, which I think is urgently needed.
And do you think there are possible knock-on effects in justiciability or the risk that the state falls foul then of a number of suits, maybe from individuals who feel their rights haven't been vindicated?
And look, David can speak to those things much more eloquently and with greater experience than I can. But let me say two things. In an ideal world, enshrining the right shouldn't mean that we end up fighting these battles in the courts. In the first instance, it should act as a stimulus for government, whoever that government is, to progressively realise that right, because that's why you want it in there. For example, the political rights that we have in the Constitution, weren't designed to open up the floodgates of litigation. It was to create the kind of the legal parameters and the rule-based framework within which politicians would then make policy decisions. So in the first instance, it would only be a bad government on the other side of that referendum which would open the way to such litigation. But what I would also say is, as we have seen in the history of the state, sometimes very, very important shifts in government policy, shifts that have taken far too long, come on foot of such litigation. So such litigation has a value. It doesn't cross over in the separation of powers. It is still up to government to decide how to vindicate that right in terms of the policy choices. But there are occasions, for example, today, we have families that will spend their fourth Christmas in emergency accommodation. We have children who have spent four formative years of their lives in emergency accommodation. And here's the point. If you listen to child development psychologists and doctors, if you listen to social workers and care workers, the impact that such an experience has on the development of children, physical, emotional, et cetera, is so grave that if government doesn't address this problem, then clearly having a judiciable right to housing in the Constitution could help reducing the length of time young children spend in emergency accommodation. And that's not a bad backstop either.
Okay, Dave, would you agree with that? Or do you see any issues with the notion of enshrining this in the Constitution?
Yeah, so I think there's sort of, you know, as Owen very well outlined, there's three sort of things that a constitutional right like this can do. One is the symbolic effect of enshrining a right like this and having a debate about it. And I think Owen's point there is well taken, that this would be sort of a national conversation about the value of housing and whether or not it should be sort of elevated in this way. And particularly given that we have a constitution that strongly protects private property rights, there would be an element of sort of balance in introducing a right like this. And I think that would be an interesting conversation for people to have. The second, obviously, possible effect, as you've touched upon, is the idea that this goes to court. And ultimately, you know, in Owen's proposal, and I think in most of the other proposals that we've seen, the suggestion is to put this right in as a, in principle, justiciable right in the Constitution, so people can go to court and they can plead it. And that obviously can potentially lead to judgments against the state that could potentially require housing policy to be augmented. I think that Owen's picked up on a couple of very important things in his discussion of that possibility. One is that you have some jurisdictions that have had some success in terms of litigation of these rights. South Africa is one, and it hasn't necessarily resulted in a markedly better housing system. And the South African case law on the right to housing is fascinating. It's had some positive effects, particularly in terms of perhaps forcing government engagement with people who are in very difficult situations with nowhere to go and were squatting. The courts have sort of forced government to engage with them rather than perhaps abandon them, which was the other option. But generally speaking, you know, South Africa's housing situation was bad at the time the constitution was written, remains not great today, and occasional intervention by the courts hasn't solved that problem. So I think that you know, Owen's right to say that people advocating this don't want a judicial solution to these problems. What the judiciary can provide is a backstop in very extreme cases, in cases of sort of abject state failure. And I think that we hope we don't get to that point. And we, you know, a popular endorsement of a proposal like this would ideally spur government action that would keep us well away from the point where our judges would intervene. I personally think our judges would be very loath to do that, would be very reluctant to really weigh in on housing policy in a detailed way, absent the most extreme cases. And the final possibility, I think Owen's talked about this very eloquently, is the possibility that this spurs action in terms of you know, government policy and causes a shift in thinking on housing. And for me, as sort of a constitutional lawyer, one of the most important aspects of that perhaps is counterbalancing what are perceived to be very strong protections of private property in the Constitution. We've seen repeatedly with Pills from Owen and others that the Attorney General will weigh in and suggest that bills that, you know, perhaps restrict property rights of landlords or landowners might be unconstitutional. And some of those bills might be measures that could address our housing crisis. I often disagree with that advice. I think the Attorney General has often been too cautious and too conservative in saying that something might be unconstitutional for property rights reasons. I don't know that the backing is there in recent case law for that position. But, you know, that's happened. The Attorney General has managed to sort of stymie proposals on the basis that it's unconstitutional by virtue of private property. Adding in a right like this would change that equation. You would have to reconsider any private property question balanced against the good done for this right to housing. And that changes your constitutional calculation. So in that respect, you could have really significant effects on political debate and discussion and legislation. And I think for many advocates of this proposal, it's there rather than in the courts that people see the real potential benefit, opening up the policy solutions rather than looking to judges to save us. Because I think, people with experience of that sort of litigation, as Owen said, it can occasionally do a lot of good, but those cases are rare. And if you want systemic solutions that work for the majority of people, the answer is policy and the answer is legislation.
Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't the Constitution always about balancing the rights of the various different sectors within society? And as you've made reference there to the private property protection elements of the Constitution, and obviously, if this were to pass, then you have that juxtaposition of the two rights. Do you not see a circumstance where people, I mean, Owen made reference to the fact that there are lots of people in the housing system who are not being served adequately at the moment. Would they not have a case to take against the state in such a circumstance?
Yes, I mean, I think they would. I mean, the question is, would the courts be willing to find in their favour? I actually think, personally, there's an interesting case potentially to be taken now. We don't have an express right to housing, but the courts have never ruled on the existence of an unenumerated, or now, as we say, after July, a derived right to housing. That's our new language from the Supreme Court judgment in the Friends of the Irish Environment case. There's an interesting possibility that our current situation presents some very extreme cases and people could go to court and claim their rights could be infringed even now. Obviously, that would be sort of a very novel kind of case. In the event that we had a right like this in the Constitution, I expect those cases would come to court. And in particular, you'll find after a new right is recognized in the courts or something is added to the Constitution, often there's a flurry of litigation. People try and work out, what does this new right the Supreme Court has recognized really mean? Or what are the, you know, children's rights, you know, how do we unpack what children's rights might be after we've inserted them into the Constitution? And so what you would probably have would be a few years where there might be strategic litigation, seeing if the rights put into the Constitution could advance the cause of people who are kind of falling through the cracks at the moment. I personally think the success that you might have, even after an amendment like Owen's, might be modest. I think the courts would be very slow to sort of tell the state what to do in terms of housing policy. I think the most likely victory you would win is to get a judgment saying that the policy adopted at the moment is not doing enough or doesn't meet a standard of reasonableness and must do more. But the court would be very slow even to say what that would be. I think you would get, much like people might remember a few years ago, the Supreme Court found a very significant right in the Constitution that would allow asylum seekers a limited right to work, or at least a right to seek work. And the Supreme Court there said, what's wrong with the current system is they can't work at all. They could be in this asylum system for 7 or 8 years and can never work in any job in any circumstance. What needs to change is something. We're not going to say what. It doesn't have to be all sorts of jobs. Maybe you could just get them through the system quicker and the infringement on this right wouldn't be so bad. You work it out. I expect that sort of the biggest win you could expect in the housing context would be something similar. The Supreme Court would say, you're not doing enough. You need to do better. But we don't know what better looks like. And obviously that would be a significant statement. It would spur political action, but it also wouldn't solve our problems. And I think that's probably what we would, in a best case scenario, hope from the judiciary with a right to housing. That would be my personal view.
Yeah. I mean, you've had a chance to look at Owen's bill, and what it proposes is a new Article 43A in the Constitution. And it's a two-part article. The state recognizes the right to appropriate and affordable housing, essential for an adequate standard of living for every person and family. The state accordingly shall take appropriate steps to ensure the realization of this right. And then the second part is the state shall take reasonable steps to prevent and reduce homelessness with a view to its gradual elimination. How do you feel about the wording of that? Do you have any misgivings about it? Do you feel that it will affect a different approach if it were passed?
So yeah, I think it's a good approach that you know, what we're focusing on in Owen's bill is, again, the state taking appropriate steps to ensure realization of the right. And so the focus again is on gradual progressive realization of this standard of, you know, of housing, which is recognized as being sort of essential for a standard of living. And this, you know, mirrors various international protections, like the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and the European Social Charter would have quite similar provisions, would use some of the same language that Owen has drawn out, I'm sure, drawing inspiration from those important international agreements. And again, the idea of, you know, gradually moving toward elimination of homelessness suggests that we're not looking for quick fix solutions. As Owen said, we're not giving everyone keys to a house. We don't think that's realistic. We're looking for those gradual steps. Certainly, it does open up the pathway to court. You can say that the state isn't doing enough to gradually eliminate homelessness, or is not taking sufficient steps to realize those rights. What you would probably have in those court cases would be, we don't know what the courts would do, but you suspect it would be something like the South Africans, the South African Constitutional Court has adopted an approach that's in legal circles known as group boom reasonableness, after the case that coined that term. And what the state, you know, has to do is show the court that its housing policy is reasonable. The South African government has failed to do that on several occasions, such as where it had a long-term housing plan for everyone, but basically abandoned people in the short term to squat and live in shanty towns with no state aid at all. You know, South African constitutional court said that wasn't good enough. You have to have a short-term plan and a long-term plan to eliminate homelessness. So, you know, that's the kind of case that you could see coming to court, and you could see the state's policy being held up by judges and looked at. But again, I wouldn't see sort of a judge-made housing policy, or, you know, judges who mightn't be great experts in this deciding to weigh in and to tell the minister exactly what to do. So for my perspective, I think a bill like Owen's, or he discussed the proposal from Home for Good, those proposals seem to be carefully drawn to try and, again, not close out the possibility of courts getting involved, but really to spur state action and to spur policy innovation, and not to hand over the keys to the housing policy sphere to judges entirely. I think it's been quite carefully done in that way.
Owen, would you accept that's the purpose behind it? I mean, you said earlier that it wasn't a silver bullet. Is it really to just spur on a change in public policy?
Absolutely. I mean, look, I'm somebody who's worked in housing policy, both in the elected sphere and in the NGO sphere, for over 20 years. And it's something I've written extensively about and published on. And obviously, I have my preferred policy options, but they're not the only policy options. And if you look around, for example, the European Union at the moment, there are Christian democratic governments that have a very different set of policy prescriptions to the ones I prefer. But they find a way to meet housing need among larger sections of the population. Likewise, for example, there are countries that might have maybe a more centrist, liberal policy set of preferences who use other policies. And it's really important when an advocate of the constitutional right to housing, such as me, proposes a wording. I'm not using it to say the policies that, if I were the Minister for Housing, I would implement get privileged positions. And I think that's a really important point to say, so that I think what the spur is to say, whoever is in government, whatever their ideological or policy-based preferences, they have to be able to demonstrate that they're progressively realizing this right. And let's take an example, because often it's when you discuss this stuff at the extremes that it becomes very clear. So we've had a long-standing problem in this state with adequate accommodation for the traveller community, particularly travellers who want to live nomadically. And a number of years ago, government rightly said that local authorities would have a legal obligation to produce a traveller accommodation plan, something you're well aware of, as I am from our time as councillors. local authorities have a statutory obligation. They produce those plans. Those plans run for a set period of time and central government funds them. It's a very straightforward issue. And right up into the crash of 2008, central government funding for travel accommodation plans was quite significant. And in fairness to the last Fine Gael government, once we started to emerge from the last recession, Damien English, who was the Minister of State responsible, year on year started to increase that funding. Despite all of that, the spend by local authorities on traveller accommodation is currently running at about 50% of the allocation, despite the fact that there's legal statutory plans. So there is a failure in the system somewhere, whether it's at local authority level or at central government level, to implement those statutory plans. And what's very clear is money is not the primary problem. The plans and the non-existence of plans is not the primary problem. So there is very clearly a case where I think if there was a right to housing enshrined in the Constitution, I think the various actors, both in local government and central government, would sit back and say, OK, the situation has now changed. We cannot continue to allow statutorily agreed plans by local councillors to not be implemented and to return 50% of our budget allocation on an annual basis. If we don't want to end up in court, we better do something about this to fix the problem. Now, it's not an easy problem to fix. I live in the real world and I'm in a constituency that has a very, very large, both settled and nomadic traveller community. But that is an instance where I actually think having this right in the Constitution would force a change. And my preference would be that change would be the legislators and the policymakers would fix that problem. But if we continue to fail to do so, then clearly there would be a strong case in such circumstances for this to then be resolved in the courts. And I absolutely agree with David. Judges are not housing policy experts. They have no place dictating to government how government should realise that right. But what they should be able to do is to say, you are failing to realise that right, and we are demanding of you to do something different to what you're currently doing. Now, because of the separation of powers, off you go back into the Oireachtas and work out how to fix this problem so that it doesn't come back to us in another court case at some point in the future.
David, can I come back to you on that issue, let's say, of the statutory programmes that aren't having effect at local authority level? Is it not justiciable for parties in those cases to sue on foot of the statutory scheme without a constitutional basis?
Yeah, I mean, so there's kind of a couple of interesting possibilities there. One is that you could actually, and this is something that, as Owen mentioned, Mercy Law Resource Centre has done some really interesting work on, putting something like a right to housing on a statutory footing can be really useful in those situations, that it can sort of, you know, be used as a statutory right to force action at local authority level, on ground level, in terms of following through on statutory commitments. And that's something that, let's say, in Scotland has been noted to be markedly useful in certain cases. The problem with, let's say, a statutory scheme, as Owen discussed for travellers, is that often the statute won't be framed in a way that gives anyone an entitlement for the local authority to behave in any particular way, right? So to go into court and to seek to sort of force the local authority to draw down more money or to augment their plans can be very difficult, and framing that legal claim could be challenging. And I think Owen's absolutely right that while potentially a statutory right could do something like that as well, having that right on a constitutional level could give the courts a framework for holding local authority action in that case to be unreasonable, right? And particularly rights like this, when they are useful in the judicial context, it's almost always because some group has been left out of policy, that some group has been overlooked or excluded, and essentially even lobbying through the ordinary political channels hasn't solved that problem, then potentially courts will get involved. Again, not to dictate a precise solution, but to say this has to be better. And again, it can solve then both statutory failures. So if statutes fail to provide for those groups, a constitutional right could be useful there. A statutory right couldn't do that. Statutory right couldn't sort of force a statutory change, or wouldn't give the courts a power to find that a statute was not doing enough or was unreasonable. A constitutional right would. So again, there are sort of different levels of protection, and the constitutional level gives you this added possibility of reviewing legislative action as well as potentially on the ground implementation that excludes certain groups to their detriment.
Thanks, David. I wonder, I mean, obviously there are lots of private members' bills and lots of legislation that amends the Constitution, some of which becomes law, some of which doesn't. In terms of the kind of, this is more, I suppose, the process side of things, the bill itself is a 39th Amendment, but there's several 39th Amendments bills that are before the Houses at the moment. Do you know anything about how... about the structure of the bill, or how, for example, how it goes through? So, for example, it's in English and Irish. Is that a requirement, do you know, of legislation? Or Owen, maybe you know, because having drafted the bill, if this is something you gave consideration to?
Well, I suppose let's take a step back, first of all. Whenever opposition are tabling constitutional amendment bills, we know that even if the bill were to pass second stage, so for example, Joan Collins's water and public ownership bill from 2016 passed second stage. But we also know that for a referendum to proceed, the Attorney General of the government has to advise the government on the wording. And it is highly likely that in the course of committee stage, wording would change. So therefore, I suppose when I table a bill like this, I know that I don't have the legal expertise that's available to government. Obviously, I consult with various people and we have the Office of Parliamentary Legal Advice and we choose to use that. But really, when you table a bill like this in the first instance, while you do everything you can to make it robust and credible, you also know that it'll go into the political process. So what I'd really like to come from this is to provoke a debate. If and when it gets to the floor of the Dáil for it to enter into or to pass second stage again into committee, and then for government to take over. And we've had a number of occasions like this, and maybe by way of example, we had a particular difficulty, and it's not a constitutional matter, but a particular difficulty with double-digit student rent increases some years ago, and government wasn't minded to act. So some of us drafted legislation, we had a pass through second stage. But then the minister did the right thing. He called us in and he said, okay, look, I respect the fact that the Dáil has agreed this. I'm going to take this away and I'm going to get my officials and the Attorney General to make sure that this is done in the right way. At that point, we, of course, said absolutely. And if the minister then tables something that is crafted in a better way, but has the same import as what we wanted and what the Dáil had approved, then we withdraw our legislation and we'll support the governments. That's what I'd like to happen in this. Now, we've also been overtaken by Home for Good. And I just want to emphasize this. What's really interesting about the Home for Good project, and it's been quite some time in gestation, is that here is a group of people with far greater legal expertise, and they've even gone to some extent to do opinion polling and other things. And they have provided a wording. So I suppose my current political position, just so you're clear, is that Home for Good and their efforts, in my view, have superseded my efforts. And what I'd like to see the current government do is engage with them directly and consider their wording, which is different to mine and I think is superior to mine on the basis of my reading. And then for the government to bring that to the Attorney General and for a government bill to be introduced, because if we're going to have a referendum, it ultimately has to have the support of this government because they have a majority. And I would much prefer to be in a situation where Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, the Greens, supported by Sinn Féin, Labour, the Soc Dems and others, are all weighing in behind the most robust proposal possible. So look, while obviously we may or may not seek to introduce my bill at second stage, given that Home for Good has now presented its wording to the Oireachtas Committee, that the Oireachtas Housing Committee has by a majority, although not a unanimity, because Fine Gael are still considering the matter, I think is probably the best way to put it. But a clear majority of the Oireachtas Housing Committee are supportive of Home for Good proposal. I think the political circumstances have changed and it's now up for government to consider Home for Good's wording and re-engage with the Oireachtas Housing Committee and the Dáil and the Seanad to see where we're going. The Minister for Housing is on record as saying he'd like to see a referendum to enshrine the right to housing in the Constitution. That isn't what the Programme for Government says, as you know, Barry. It says to hold a referendum on housing. And there will be a discussion in oral questions with the Minister for Housing on foot of a priority question I've submitted next week to try and tie down, is the position of the Minister the position of the government in terms of the referendum? And if not, what is the position of government? Because that's materially relevant to what I do with my bill and what Home for Good does with their advocacy campaign.
Okay. So in terms then, I mean, this is really a spur to move the debate along, but you anticipate it will ultimately be overtaken by other legislation, and you don't intend to bring it forward in, let's say, private members' time in the Dáil.
So my original intention, so obviously the bill was introduced at first stage, so my original intention...
The 6th of October came into the Dáil, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. So my original intention was to try and seek leave at second stage through the private members' lottery system, which selects bills randomly on a monthly basis. What I did do is, after Home for Good published their wording and presented to the Oireachtas Housing Committee, and the Oireachtas Housing Committee agreed to write to the Minister to urge the Minister to meet Home for Good, I then withdrew my bill from the lottery. What I don't want is this debate to be confused by multiple wordings. And again, like, this is not to say that we don't put a lot of effort when we draft opposition bills. We do. But what's really important here is the best possible wording based on the most comprehensive legal advice is the wording that if we do have a referendum is put forward. And I am more than happy to defer, first of all, to the legal expertise that Home for Good have, and ultimately to the legal expertise and the advice of an Attorney General, albeit an Attorney General who I think is quite conservative with a small c on some of these matters. And that's not a criticism of his competence. It's just a reflection, I think, of where he positions himself on these legal matters. But I would always defer if there is better wording from government, if there is better wording from third parties that government is considering, then I'll get behind that. Because what I want is the right to housing enshrined in the Constitution in the best possible way, leaving aside party political advantage issues.
I accept entirely what you're saying there. In terms of the process, you were saying that you got assistance in drafting this from, there is assistance within Leinster House for various members who want to draft legislation. How much of this, if you don't mind my asking, did you draft? How much of it is a committee coming together? How much of it is dictated by other people outside Sinn Féin?
So I suppose the way in which opposition parties draft bills is interesting. We do now have the Parliamentary Legal Service, which is a great advantage, although in this instance I didn't use those because this is a piece of work I'd worked on previously. Often opposition TDs, myself included, will consult with a wide range of people. Often those people would prefer if our consultations are kept confidential because they may not be aligned with any political party and therefore they don't want to be associated with the work of a particular political party, and that's legitimate. Often we would consult with academic experts, with legal practitioners. What I would say in relation to this bill, however, is that, to go back to what I said at the start, we've had now 5, and prior to the publication of this bill, 4 detailed Oireachtas hearings on the matter. We've had presentations from legal experts, both Irish and international. We've had significant legal research produced by the Mercy Law on 3 separate reports, including discussions and descriptions of the text. So when I drafted this bill in the first instance, I drew on all of that and presented the bill. But I do think it's important to say that, again, when you present a bill, you always need to be open to the bill progressing because people support the intent. But then at committee stage, you listen to the considered views of others. And what I would really like, for example, if the government decides not to proceed with a referendum, then whether it's the Home for Good wording or my wording, we would like to at least get into committee. And then for committee to hear, and the great thing about committee, as you know, Barry, is that provides an opportunity to bring in experts, to bring in legal expertise, to get additional views from the Office of Parliamentary Legal Advice, etc. Ultimately, we want the most robust bill possible. And this particular bill, probably from my point of view, has had more input from more different sources than a lot of the other legislation. But that's probably because we've had so much discussion of this, including, of course, the Constitutional Convention and the very significant deliberations and debates that took place there and their final report on the matter.
David, I don't know how much you get to follow this from outside the Oireachtas, because obviously you have a real job, some people might say, in terms of this kind of thing. Have you seen the Home for Good wording, for example? I know this group was, I think, founded by Anne Fitzgerald last year, or maybe even earlier than that. How much do you liaise or follow this kind of thing?
Yeah, very, very closely. I should probably declare an interest in this insofar as my wife is a member of Home for Good. She works with Focus Ireland. So as a result, I tend to know what they're up to, but I'm not affiliated with them myself. So yeah, their wording, I think, is similar to Owen's and draws on a lot of the same ideas. And I think it's great to see a sort of a building consensus around the kind of constitutional language that advocates from different quarters want to see go in. I think, you know, a couple of really interesting points coming out of what Owen said there. You know, it is very important that there is the involvement of the Office of the Attorney General in drafting constitutional language, not least because of something like, you know, the Irish text and the English text being as close as possible, and making sure that the Irish text of the Constitution will be authoritative, so making sure there's no great conflicts and unintended consequences of that. But you'll also find in the process of the Attorney General advising on a constitutional amendment, there may be, as kind of I think Owen has hinted at, some potential friction in terms of things like, to take an example from Owen's bill, the idea of appropriate and affordable housing. It may be the view among some lawyers that that's vague when it comes to constitutional language. What's a court, you know, supposed to do with that? I wouldn't think that's a particular problem, but it would be something that would be put out in debate a lot, that for the Constitution, we need to be really clear. The reality is that the Constitution contains a lot of quite vague language we need the courts to unpack. And again, we need to trust the courts not to go overboard in insisting on affordable must mean exactly this, but give the Oireachtas leeway to do its job in determining that. But those are the sort of issues that might come up in terms of, you know, negotiating a final language. And I think it'll be really important that while those concerns are aired and debated, that we don't rely too much on sort of really narrow legal advice, that lots of people come in, that lots of people debate it, and that, you know, we can't be totally insisting on language that's clear and specific and leaves no doubt, because that's really not how constitutions are written. One interesting point as well about the numbering, our constitutional amendment numbering is very strange. You know, we talk about things like the Eighth Amendment and so on, and you would think then that there's an amendment for every number, but there isn't. Sometimes amendment bills get offered in batches, and if one of them fails, and it's one of the earlier numbers, that number is then lost. So there is no 12th Amendment to the Irish Constitution, for example. It goes 11-13, because the 12th Amendment failed and the 13th Amendment passed on the same day. So the numbering is very much determined on the order in which the bill is actually finally put through the Oireachtas, and then it's given a number which will be the ultimate number of the amendment if it passes. So it creates some real quirks. You'd be looking through the Constitution for a 12th Amendment and you'll never find it. And so we have some very, very strange processes around that.
I mean, the 38th Amendment obviously was divorce rights, that the last referendum took place, I think, at the same time as the last local elections in 2019. In terms of, if I'm right in saying this, there's a number of bills currently in one or both, one or either house in the Oireachtas that are called the 39th Amendment to the Constitution Bill. And it depends on which one gets there first, really, as to whether it becomes a 39th Amendment.
It's a race to be the real 39th Amendment. Yes. Will be the first one.
It happens to be a particularly slow and at times frustrating race for some of us.
Yeah. If David, you might be able to answer this question. If, for example, this bill did go all the way through and set up a constitutional referendum that subsequently failed, that it would remain the 39th Amendment. It just wouldn't actually be amendment. The next bill would then become the 40th Amendment. Is that right?
Well, so if it fails, you can reuse the number. But if two referendums happen in sequence, so that then let's say the 39th Amendment was something like Owen's bill, and then there was another amendment on the same day that was the 40th. And let's imagine the 39th fails, but the 40th passes. Then the 39th Amendment is gone. You can't go back. It must go forward. So you can reuse a number if the referendum fails on its own. But if a subsequent amendment of a higher number is passed, then the lower number disappears. So it creates some very strange quirks if you look back to the numbering of.
If it was the other way around, if the 39th passed and the 40th failed, then the next referendum would still be the 40th Amendment.
There would be a new 40th Amendment. Yes. You'd get a second chance. So, and obviously it only becomes the 39th Amendment to the Constitution Act rather than bill in the event of its final sort of, you know, passage through the Oireachtas. That's when we lock in that number for the sake of a referendum, but then it has to be, actually sort of, you know, passed by the people and signed by the president to formally become an act of the Oireachtas and change the constitution.
Right. So no shortage of technical quirks there anyway. I think...
Do you mind take us off on just a slight tangent?
Yeah.
Because there's when we have these conversations all of the time, there's an underlying assumption that we have a very rigid constitution, which elevates private property rights to an exceptionally high level, to such an extent that government's hands are very, very tied in introducing policies that may, for very good social policy reasons, constrain those private rights. There's a strong view, and I know David has written about it, as has his colleagues, that in fact a lot of the more recent case law suggests the opposite, that our constitution is far more permissive in terms of how it sees these things. And the Part 5 of the Planning Development Act in 2000, for example, which again, you know well as your time on the council, is a really good case in point. And I do think it's worthwhile because we need to get away from this idea that government's hands are tied. I have a particular view, and you may disagree with it, Barry, but often governments will use the constitutional private property rights argument as an excuse not to take action.
Governments, in fairness.
Sure, absolutely. But I'm just saying, ultimately, because it's governments who decide whether to take action or not, it's when they do this, it's particularly concerning for many of us. And this relates then back to our choices of attorneys general, in the sense that David will often make the point, and I've heard him say this publicly, that you know, legal advice is legal advice, and depending on who you go to, you get a different advice. But we do have a history in this state of appointing attorneys general who take a more restrictive interpretation of this matter. Now, they're entitled to do that. It's a perfectly legitimate legal and academic point. But there is a growing body of scholarship, and again, David can speak much more eloquently to this than I can, that will challenge that and will argue that, in fact, first of all, the Constitution is more permissive and more open. And the reason I'm saying that is because one of the other values, and it's something David hinted at, but I just want to make it more explicit, one of the other values of a constitutional right to housing would be it would make it more difficult for governments in the future to hide behind a particular interpretation of private property rights in the Constitution as an excuse for not taking policy action, even when such policy action is urgently required and publicly very popular. And I think that's an important point to add to the debate.
David, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, no, I entirely agree with Owen's characterization of it. Myself and my colleague Rachel Walsh, another constitutional lawyer in Trinity, have both sort of been fairly public in the last sort of 12 months, saying that we think that the presentation of private property rights that we've seen from now successive governments and successive attorneys general is just too conservative. You know, private property rights are supposed to be delimited in the interests of social justice and to pursue the common good. And the more recent case law, as Owen said, is simply not as negative to state action, I think, as is sometimes suggested. The problem with this, of course, is that because we don't tend to get bills that really push this question, and again, the government has declined to pursue them, we don't let the courts weigh in. You know, we have a Supreme Court that could give us a fairly definitive answer on some of these questions,
and we've never been able to get them. Do you think that governments are reluctant to put it in the laps of the courts like that?
Perhaps, and I'm unsure why, because again, with the greatest of respect to our former and current attorneys general, who are all excellent lawyers, that they are giving legal advice. They are not empowered to make final determinations on what is constitutional and what is not. Mm-hmm. And in particular, there really hasn't been a really meaty property rights case about the outer limits of the power of government since the Planning and Development Bill case in the year 2000 that Owen mentioned. And so it's sort of high time to get the judges back involved. And I understand a government desire not to push constitutional limits. They want to respect the Constitution and they want to, you know, very much stay within the lines. But with something like this, where there's major social policy issues at stake, and as Owen said, sometimes great popular support for doing more, I think it's time to let the judges weigh in and tell us what our constitutional property rights mean today. And so I think we're kind of definitely overdue that. And I also think, as Owen said, there has been perhaps in recent years, a sense, not only in the property context, but in others as well, that the Constitution is fundamentally obstructive, that it's kind of stops the Oireachtas doing things and, you know, is mostly there to tie people's hands, whereas I see it as the opposite. There are limits, there are restrictions, but the Constitution is there to empower the legislative process. And our courts have said in so many contexts, in terms of social policy, in terms of balancing the common good and rights, the first port of call is the legislature. And only you guys get to make the determination of, you know, what's the right policies to pursue. The courts will sometimes have to say the balance has been incorrectly struck, rights have been violated, but that has to be taken on as the core function of the houses to sort of, you know, really balance rights and the common good and make policy. And I think seeing the Constitution as obstructive rather than empowering is an unfortunate way to look at it. The Constitution's there to guide and occasionally to restrain, but it's really there to give us a functioning legislature that can pursue the policies that will make our country as good as it can be.
Well, on that very positive review of the Constitution in our laws, I'm going to call a halt. Eoin O'Brien, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Midwest and Sinn Féin spokesperson on housing, and Dr. David Kenny, Associate Professor of Law at Trinity College Dublin. Thank you both very much for joining me. Really appreciate your input. And that's it for the 7th episode. Please do like and share the podcast if you've enjoyed these discussions. Let other people know. We'll be back next week with another episode, and we'll talk to you then. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Irish Legislation Podcast with me, Barry Ward. You can get me on Twitter at Barry M. Ward. Don't forget to subscribe and you won't miss any of the episodes as they come up on a weekly basis while the Oireachtas is sitting.